The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So a few things about both IMC and about the hearing system devices. One is that we're completely run by volunteers here, which is a very nice thing. But sometimes we don't have volunteers to do certain things. And then it's not so nice. And we really don't have anyone who's monitoring the hearing system devices or taking care of that whole world. We have someone who took a lot of effort to put it together and research it and organize it and make it, set it all up. There's no one's really kind of, you know, tending to that. And one of the things I was told is that those of you who use it, if you would bring your own wires, you know, earplugs that plug into the machines, that would probably help, because one of the problems we've had is some of those wires get old. And then it's a simple enough thing to buy more, but it takes a volunteer. And then, you know, where is that volunteer? So so sometimes, you know, things kind of... Yeah?
I'll take care of it.
You'll take care of it.
Yeah,
you're looking for something to do. Beautiful. Thank you. See, some things... So things somehow happen here. It's kind of. I think it's quite remarkable that IMC should exist and function as well as it does. I think of it as functions on the goodwill of many, many people, because it's all one volunteers, and it's, people come from far away sometimes, or they expect that we are kind of, I don't know what, they expect us to be much more evolved, developed, institutionalized. We even get letters sometimes from people say, you know, especially from abroad, asking if they can come and be in residence here. Because, you know, our presence in the world is actually quite large, so we must be bigger than we seem. So, okay. So, good morning, everyone. And I would like to talk a little bit about important practice topic in our tradition that's usually described as vedana. Vedana sometimes is translated as feeling. And in kind of introducing this topic, it's kind of an idea where sometimes it's useful to go back to basics. It's good to go back to the beginning. Sometimes I've been in conversations, difficult conversations with people trying to find our way with it. And I say, well, let's hold it. Let's stop. let's start over again. Let's start at the beginning and kind of build what's going on so we really understand each other, because we're missing each other or it's gotten too complicated. So the idea of going back to the beginning, going back to the starting over, I think is part of this idea of being mindful of the vedana, the feeling of our experience. What exactly this word vedana means is interesting. I don't really know what exactly it means in the time of the Buddha, but I think it's a very rich and valuable idea or experience. And one way to get to it is if you take your finger and you press it against your thigh. You don't press too hard, so you don't want no bruises, but you press a little bit hard. And you, right there where your finger is pressing against the thigh, you have sensations. You have sensation of pressure, maybe some other sensations that come along with that. And what's interesting is the way in which the sensation and the sensing in the thigh are happening at the same place at the same time. They're kind of non-dual. They're not. You can't really distinguish the sensing and the sensation in that place where they're happening. They happen together, right? So you have the sensing and sensation that's kind of there in the thigh. But then, separate from that, there has to be a mental event that knows that that's pressure, knows the event that's happening. And with that mental event of some kind of knowing, based on that, we have further reactions and responses. If it's your own finger pushing against it, then you know, it seems maybe relatively neutral. If I had you instead, during this exercise, take your finger and poke it into the person next to you. You would have known the pressure, and you would have probably known a lot more. A lot more would have been going on in the mind. The sensation would have been the same, But the way that we know the sensation, the way it's experienced, separate from the sensation, gets a little more complicated much more quickly. And so we can distinguish the sensation itself from the way that sensation registers mentally as a knowing an event. And so it's this knowing of the basic registering of an event which is the vedana, not the sensation itself. So it has a kind of a mental component. And it's a form of knowing. The word vedana means to know, or act of knowing. And there are many ways in which that kind of knowing at that very basic level occurs. But in order to have any kind of mental response to the world, or any kind of response, you know, to the world, that's more than, I don't know what it's called, you know, when you put your hand on the stove and the nervous system kind of, it just doesn't go to the brain, it goes to the spine and back, and we pull our hand back. I guess that doesn't involve knowing. That's vedana. That's just like, I don't know what it is. What? It's a reflex.
A spinal tactile reflex.
No. When things have to be done really quickly, they go, just there's a loop through the spine. But then, you know, then we usually don't know it after the fact, right?
Yeah. It's actually to draw your attention. You'll look. If you put your hand on a hot burner,
yeah,
you will automatically focus on that, and that's part of the reflex loop.
Oh, so as you pull your hand away, you look.
As you injure yourself, you look.
But what about the pulling back?
I think the pulling back is also part of it. But then there's conscious awareness.
The conscious knowing, the conscious awareness. So what we're talking about is vedana has to do with this conscious knowing, conscious that goes on in the brain. It can be very complex. It can be very simple what that is. But to kind of illustrate its importance, this connection between sensation and this simple knowing, you can imagine an hourglass. So an hourglass has a wide top and a wide base. It has this narrow, you know, neck. And so if on one end is the whole universe, the whole world of things you can experience out in the world. I mean, it's pretty complicated out there beyond your skin. And all the stuff that's beyond your skin, comes in through your eyes and your ears and your nose and your tongue and your tactile sensations, and you know what's going on. But all the stuff that's out there, which is so complex and diverse, in order for you to know it, has to kind of be channeled into this little neck of through our senses. So in Buddhism, it would be these five sense doors that we take in the external world, and then with that going through that neck, it has to continue into this very simple, also very narrow world of the simple knowing of the experience. And from that simple knowing of the experience, the funnel spreads out again into a really big universe again. And so there's this very big universe beyond our skin, and there's this huge universe within our skin, you know, the whole mental world. And for some of you, probably your mental world is bigger than the external world that you live in. You know, because, you know, we have tremendous capacity to, you know, the world just always lives just in the present moment. And you get to improve on that by by living in the past and the future and then in fantasy, and, you know, there's no time at all. And, you know, so your universe can be argued because it's much bigger, right? So you have this big funnel, right? So this whole experience of the world and how we know it, how the inner world is going to spread back out into the world and have contact with the external world, actually happens through this very narrow neck. The simplest way of thinking of it is through the five senses. But the senses would be the physical aspect, and the vedana would be the mental aspect of it, of these two things. Make sense? The mental knowing of it. Make some sense? So if you want to, in the ancient world, they said that if you had a walled city with one gate, if you had a person stationed at the gate, the one gate going into the city, then that person could know everybody who came and left the city, because everyone had to go through that gate. And so in the same way with our world, if we stay present at where this funnel, where this narrow neck or this gate occurs, then we can know a lot about the moment-to-moment experience of our world, how we build our world, how we affect our world, what goes on. There's a lot of information that's possible to be had right there. And it's one of the reasons why we put so much emphasis in Buddhism, Buddhist practice, on being in the present moment, so that we can kind of be simple enough, quiet enough, we can notice where things happen right there at that gate or that neck of the hourglass, change the metaphor. And so a lot can be seen in that place. What is this knowing? This very simple knowing might involve some very simple evaluation. So, as you know, if you take your hand and put it on your thigh, maybe it's a neutral experience. If you're extremely attracted to the person next to you and you have fantasies about them, and they put their hand on your thigh, you say, "Oh, that's nice. That's pleasant." But then there's someone who, for whatever reason, you find not particularly appealing sitting next to you. They might have studied compassionate touch. They might have been a world expert masseuse. And they touch you very nicely. But, you know, because the person is somehow not what your fantasy image is of an appealing person, they what is this about? This, I'd rather not have any contact. I came to be alone. I don't want anybody entering my space. This is unpleasant. Even though so we evaluate sometimes based on what this inner universe wants, what it imagines, what its memories are, what its associations are. And so we experience things as pleasant and unpleasant partly because it's evaluative. Pleasant and unpleasant isn't only in the nature of the experience, it's also evaluative. And so when I was a kid, when the first few times I drank coffee, I couldn't believe that adults drank this stuff. It was just awful. I call it dishwashing water. And now, every morning I get up, I look forward to my cup of coffee. I think it's very good. So what happened to me? Probably the coffee got better. So based on this knowing, we do a simple evaluation. Partly it's evaluative. And based on the evaluation, based on whether we think it's pleasant or unpleasant, then we can sometimes respond and react to it. So one of the ways in which this pleasant and unpleasant nature of our experience, this very simple evaluative thing works, helpfully, is that we can be in situations that are quite complex. Remember this big, the funnel goes out in the world and it's quite difficult, complicated situations. And our mind will sometimes will try to figure out what's going on. It's a difficult, challenging situation. And trying to dissect it, trying to analyze it, trying to find out what's going on in order to have some ease in the situation. But some people find that one way to find ease in a challenging situation is to metaphorically step back and consider, is this pleasant or unpleasant, this situation? And if it's unpleasant, some people find by simply acknowledging or seeing this is an unpleasant situation, that's enough to somehow release our being caught in the situation or release our contraction around the situation. It's an unpleasant situation. It's just an unpleasant situation. And that simplification of it all can sometimes help us create a little more distance from the experience, a little more ease with it. Maybe you've learned how to be with unpleasant situations. It's just unpleasant. It doesn't have to be any different. It's just unpleasant. And given that it's unpleasant right now, I'll just, treat it more with ease. And I don't have to analyze it to its perfection in order to kind of solve the problem. I just have to realize that it's unpleasant, and I can kind of not just kind of hold it lightly. It's an unpleasant situation. The same thing with a pleasant situation. There are situations, things that are very pleasant, and there might be a lot of scheming and planning about how to want more of it, or how to own it, or get it, or do something. And one of the questions, to just realize, oh, just a pleasant situation, and leave it as a pleasant situation. Many years ago, I studied with a Zen master, a Rinzai Zen master named Robert Aitken. And he gave a koan that we were supposed to pass. And I forget, actually, how the koan went. I forgot most of the koans and the answers, luckily. at least the answers. And the koan, I apologize if I probably have it wrong and it maybe doesn't come across right, but it was something like, he tailor-made it to me, so as a man, a heterosexual man, he said, you know, if a woman comes along and smiles at you, what do you do? And he said, so the answer was you smile and keep walking. Was the answer somehow. I don't know if that's I don't know if it represents the story, but the story being you don't have to, the fact that something is pleasant, you don't have to react negatively to it. You don't have to want it and get it or do something. You can just enjoy it, smile, and continue on your way. Just let it be something pleasant, was the idea. So it makes sometimes can make the world a lot simpler to negotiate if we just recognize, oh, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, and then we can find a more balanced way to be with it. It's not meant to be a way that dismisses anything kind of ignores what's really going on. It's one way, one avenue of finding some peace or some ease in the midst of it, if we have some dis-ease or some caughtness in the situation. So most experiences have either pleasant or unpleasant qualities to it. And sometimes the Buddha said there's a third quality to it, situations that are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And this neither pleasant nor unpleasant is an interesting one that has a lot to do, the effect on how we experience it has a lot to do with the level of mindfulness, the level of consciousness in which we experience it. In ordinary life, a lot of our consideration of things is quite evaluative. We're constantly evaluating what's going on, sometimes in very complicated ways. And one of the complicated ways that we evaluate is how does the experience I'm having, how does situation affect my sense of self? Does it bolster my sense of self? Does it diminish my sense of self? So, for example, if some people, when they're praised, they feel enlivened by the praise. Some people, when they're criticized, are enlivened in a different way. They're energized by the criticism. You know, if you want to get someone's attention and criticize them. If they're sleepy, criticize them. And you know, they'll wake up. I mean, don't do that, please, but this is just a teaching point. And the sad thing is that sometimes the situation doesn't, neither situation or the people we're with, neither bolsters a self or criticizes a self, just does nothing. Some people get bored. They have no interest in that person. That situation has no value because everything is seen through the filter of what has value for the self that I'm trying to maintain and build. So that's a fairly complicated evaluation. In strong states of meditation, where the more complicated conceptual evaluation of the mind is put to rest for a while, then the experience of neither pleasant nor unpleasant, they say, actually is kind of pleasant. Because in very deep states of meditation, it's very nice to stay peaceful and not have any input coming in. And so when things are neither pleasant or unpleasant, it's just less complicated for the mind than pleasant or unpleasant. And so they say it's a kind of very special kind of pleasure of not having things coming along. You know, it's kind of like finally the refrigerator hum goes off, and that, you know, oh, that's great. You know, but if the refrigerator had never been on and someone said, is it pleasant or unpleasant to have the refrigerator off? You know, it's like, well, it's no experience at all, but it's pleasant in contrast to the, it's pleasant in contrast to, you know, the irritation of it being on. But even a constant pleasure can be a little bit more than we want if it's, you know, if we're sitting very peaceful and quiet. Something that's very listening to nice music, in certain situations, just feels pleasant and nice. when the mind is really, really peaceful and still and quiet and self-sufficient, very content, having music playing is just too much at that point. And so something that's pleasant, it feels so good not to have it. So the situation is neither, then the experience is neither pleasant or unpleasant, but it feels really pleasant. I know it sounds a little bit lopsided or strange, right? But you hope you follow? So one of the interesting things to evaluate or to look at is how do we respond to situations that don't really fit into the category of pleasant or unpleasant? Do you tend to get bored? Do you tend to have desires for something else? Do you tend to get discouraged? What's your relationship? The other thing to look at is what is your relationship in general to this very simple experience of pleasant and unpleasant, to comfort and being comfortable and uncomfortable. And some people have very, very kind of automatic gut reactions to these things. Some people have almost philosophies that if things aren't pleasant, the universe is off kilter. That we should have, things should always be pleasant. If things are unpleasant, it means something is wrong somewhere. Something's wrong with me. I've made a mistake. I've blown it. Something's wrong with the universe. I better, you know, write a letter to the owner. And something needs to happen. And so you might not think this way, you know, think of yourself thinking this way, but if you look very, very carefully at the role of pleasant and unpleasant, pleasure and lack of pleasure or pain in your life, you might see that it influences you in very profound kind of subterranean ways that leave you not so free. So, for example, one of the interesting evaluations to do is how much of your life is spent or devoted to the pursuit of pleasure, simple pleasure. Some people, for example, will maybe buy a car that's more than what they need just for transportation. But they want a car that brings them a pleasure to drive. And so they have to pay more for that car, which means they have to earn more money for that car. Some people rent or buy a home that's maybe a little bit more than they need to have in order to have a roof over their head and feel safe. But they want to have a place that's pleasant. Or you want to have pleasant clothes or pleasant furniture or pleasant recreational opportunities. Or, you know, it's nice to have maybe, if people still have TVs, it's nice to have a TV. But it would be really pleasant to have a big one, you know, 30 inches big, 40 inches big. Nowadays, you know, wall-to-wall TVs, all four walls, wall-to-wall TV. The way it's going, that's where we're going, right? So so it'd be pleasant, it would be nice, it'd be more enjoyable to have more, bigger, nicer, whatever. And if you know, how much of it really is needed for getting along in our life? I think my guess is a lot of things that we do because we would like the pleasure of it. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but to become conscious of how much the pursuit of pleasure is operating our life is quite, I think, a wake-up call to many people. They have never really stepped back and looked at it. You know, pleasure this, they want pleasure all the time. Or the avoidance of the unpleasant. And there's could be that for some people, that's the primary thing. They're always trying to avoid the unpleasant, looking, planning ahead and all this. And to look and see how this basic feeling tone of pleasant and unpleasant is at the center of so many different activities gives a toehold into understanding where freedom can be found. Rather than acting automatically or habitually for the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of discomfort, we can see this operating and we can have more freedom and choice about what do we want to, how do we want to react and respond to this world of pleasure and displeasure. Can we find a place to live that's free in such a way that whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, we don't have to move, we don't have to react. And this is, again, one of the nice things about meditation practice is it's possible in meditation to come to kind of a zero point, a point where the heart, the mind is peaceful, but not reacting to anything, not being for or against anything. And it can feel so good to have a mind that's relaxed, open, peaceful, that's not for or against anything, that you begin to want to live your life a little bit outside of meditation that way too. And realizing it feels really good to go anywhere and not be constantly on the patrol for pleasant and unpleasant, constantly kind of reacting to pleasant and unpleasant. We just can be present and alert and awake without the mind activated that way. The other thing that's very interesting about this Buddha's teachings about Vedana, this very simple knowing that goes on. Remember, it's that little neck of this huge two funnels, hourglasses, is that sometimes it's the very simple rudimentary knowing of an experience that people use to build whole philosophies of life. And so maybe I start with this example. Some people will ask, what's the meaning of life? That's a great philosophical question. And for some people, it's you know, there's a tremendous amount of deep concern around that question. What's the meaning of life? One way to address that question is not to answer it, but rather to with an answer, but rather answer it with a question. And the question would be, why are you asking? Or even better, what's motivating your question? And if people look, a fair number of people will find that there's one of two possible, I think, general possible answers to that, why that question is being asked. One is, it just logically seems like a nice question to ask. It's an interesting philosophical question. And then you can take a class in college where they explore this kind of question. The other is that it involves some angst, some anxiousness, some fear about, you know, what am I supposed to do in this world? If the answer is anxiety or fear, what happens if you turn your mindfulness back and look at the fear directly? And perhaps that fear, if you understand it well, see the roots of it, maybe that fear can be settled without having the question answered. And if the question, if the fear is settled without the question answered, what happens to the motivation to have the question answered? How important is it to find out the meaning of life if you have no more the fear that's generating the question? Does it make some sense? I hope this makes some sense. Okay, so you have this huge, you could start looking into the philosophy of life, and it's a huge quagmire of philosophy and concerns, and you know, you can have to read a lot of books, and so you can save yourself a lot of reading and a lot of thinking if you, rather than trying to figure out the good philosophy of life, if you go look at what is motivating it inside of you, the emotional motivation, and settle that. Maybe there's a different approach to deal with that than get an answer. This is not to negate the value of considering the meaning of life, and it has its place to consider those things. But the emotional involvement with that question is very different if it's motivated by fear or motivated by wisdom or curiosity or interest in how to live a wise life. So this is an example which is rather than going into this huge universe, expanded funnel of philosophy, we go closer to the beginning, to the neck, where the gate where it all kind of comes in and out, and the gate of the emotions there. So the same thing, the Buddha had said the same thing, he's a similar thing, where he wanted to argue that all the philosophies that he could enumerate in his time, religious philosophies of his time, had at their origin someone's rudimentary vedana, someone's rudimentary simple knowing that is they're closely connected to this gate where our senses and experience of the world begins. And then based on that simple knowing, people then build a philosophy on that. What the Buddha in one famous discourse, didn't exactly criticize all those philosophies. What he wanted to say, those philosophies begin with the Vedana, with the simple knowing. And what I teach is not a philosophy. My teach is to bring mindfulness to that act of knowing. What's that act of knowing like? If you understand that act of knowing, then you can understand one of the junctures for finding freedom. And one of the things he said is, if you see that the Vedana, the simple knowing of experience, is something that's conditioned, that arises and passes, that's impermanent, that it's something we latch on to or something we can let go of, then it's possible to find freedom by not latching on. It's possible to find freedom in between the arising and passing, in between the passing and the arising. As things arise and pass and arise and pass, there's certain freedom to be found when we see it's not there. And then that freedom is possible without having a complicated religious philosophy. It might not be satisfying for those of you who want a philosophy, but the Buddha wasn't interested in philosophy, he was interested in freedom, the mind that was peaceful, still, at ease, and open. And then, and so he said, go back to the beginning. Go back to the gate of the city where things come in and out. Go back to the neck of the funnel. And really take a good look and see what's happening there. And in our particular Vipassana tradition, this very simple knowing, the thing that's most interesting to look at is that simple, is it known as being pleasant or unpleasant? Is it a pleasant or unpleasant experience? So much is built on that. So are you following me well enough? May I go on a little bit longer? Is that okay? I don't know, it's kind of... Sometimes, it's a strange thing to have these monologues. Yes, you want to ask a question?
So I have read about pleasant being equated with greed and unpleasant being equated with hate and neutral being equated with delusion. And I don't really get that last part. I mean, because I see neutral as resting, a resting place. But you're talking about boredom. Neutral could be boredom, but I think that's unpleasant, not neutral. So why is it delusion to be neutral?
Well, there are different kind of levels of, I don't know if this is the right way of saying, but different degrees, different levels of consciousness with different degrees of in which the evaluative mind is operating. So with the mind, it's somewhat complicated. The ordinary mind we walk around with when we're thinking and evaluating a lot all the time and building up a sense of self and trying to find safety or pleasure or whatever we're trying to do. Then if something is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, sometimes people don't know what to do. If it's neither unpleasant or unpleasant, then how is this supposed to help my life? What good is this for me? What am I supposed to do with it? And so some people they say are kind of lost, which is the delusion part. They don't know. Where if it's pleasant, it's like pretty clear. I want more of that. If it's unpleasant for some people, I don't want more of that. So that's kind of the idea. And the thing about boredom, I think it's very important to distinguish an event from the boredom. So if you spend time with 10-year-olds, there seems to be a large repertoire of events that I find pretty, sometimes pleasant, sometimes just fine in and of themselves, certainly not unpleasant, that are intensely boring for a 10-year-old. The situation might not be pleasant or unpleasant, but these 10-year-olds have this tremendous evaluation of, and impatience and all that. And so boredom is an activity of the mind that evaluates a situation. No situation is inherently boring, ever. So your evaluation, which is a complicated event, that's unpleasant. But the situation may or may not be. Does this answer your question?
Yes. Yeah, it helps. It's very interesting. Yes, when I studied with Yvonne Rand, she used to say that boredom was a mask for fear.
Yeah, there's all kinds of interesting. Boredom's a fascinating topic, and so you should next time you get bored, it's really good to kind of look more deeply, probe, and find out what's really going on. So some people say that have found that boredom is a cover for fear, is motivated by fear. Some people have found out that boredom is a way of keeping distant from the experience, that we're kind of like not connected. And because you have to kind of hold oneself back and not really be intimate in order to have the evaluation and judgments that this is boring. Sometimes boredom has a lot to do with our ego, with our sense of identity and how we're trying to bolster ourselves or present ourselves to the world. And so if that's not happening just the way we want, we get bored. So I don't know if it's always fear, but I think that it's just very interesting to look at.
A couple of things. I've been doing Vipassana for 35 years and body work. And the way I was trained was that relaxation is a function of concentration. So what I'm supposed to do is concentrate on where I'm touching, and the client is supposed to concentrate on where I'm touching. And when both minds are in the same spot, then the relaxation can happen. Unfortunately, I've had some clients that talk through the whole massage for the last 20 years, and I can't get them to focus, unless I push really hard, but they don't like that. That's just a comment. The other thing is that I have a friend who is going to visit his 92-year-old mother, who is very absent-minded, and he was describing that he has to go organize her paperwork, which is all over the house, which she doesn't see as a problem. And he gets very impatient because every time he goes down to L.A., this is what he has to do, and gets very impatient. So he gives me a lot of advice, so I advise to him that he watch his breath, and maybe that would help. So then the question is about impatience, sort of like boredom. The state of impatience seems to be curable by being present in the moment, but I'm just wondering.
Yeah, like with boredom, impatience is an activity in one's own mind, and there's no situation we're in which is inherently impatient. Impatience resides in the activities of our mind. And so what we're trying to do with Buddhist practice is to have some handle of taking responsibility for the activities of our own mind and not to just leave it on automatic pilot. So if there is impatience, we can bring mindfulness to it and see what activities we're participating in, what's going on in the mind that creates that evaluation of that brings out impatience. And impatience is very closely connected to frustration, which is closely connected to having expectations, desires, for example. And so we can look closely at what are the desires, what are the expectations, what are the aversions that might be operating. And so the mindfulness, we always go back and look more deeply. And then if you go deep enough, sometimes what you find that it all kind of begins with this fulcrum, from the fulcrum, is that the right word, fulcrum, or from this the touch point of something that's pleasant or unpleasant. And so being able to find some ability to be at ease when things are either pleasant or unpleasant can give a person a tremendous amount of power and strength to manage in situations which are difficult. Because it's just unpleasant. I know how to be with unpleasant. And so then you just go and are willing to be unpleasant, experience unpleasant without doing anything with it, and take care of the situation.
So the impatience is like a reaction, is another layer
reaction.
Impatience is a layer of reactivity, right? Impatience is a reactive, you know, it's the mind reacting in some way. And so, you know, I call it an activity of the mind, you're calling it a reactivity of the mind. And so either way, it's something that we can turn our mindfulness and look at and learn to be free of. So it's time to stop, but I have a couple of things I want to try to say very quickly. I appreciate the word reactivity because as the mind doesn't react, as the mind learns to be clear and still and open to the world, and not reacting, not worrying, not desiring, not wanting, some people fear that that's just a dull mind. That's just not like, you know, you're becoming a, you know, I don't know what to call it, but kind of like a dull, unresponsive, uninteresting kind of mind. But actually, it's the opposite. That when the reactive mind is not operating, and the mind is at peace and rest in itself, then there still can be the natural wellsprings of thinking, emotions, intentions, understandings, intuitions that can be there, but they don't happen through the filter of greed and hate. They don't happen through the filter of fear and attachment to self. And some people find it very hard because this, in a mind that's free, it's also free of the impulse to control the situation. And it's hard to want to let go of the control and just trust what emerges, the trust that somehow we have some kind of innate capacity to respond wisely to a situation without, you know, keeping desire or aversion, you know, with its whip, kind of keeping us going. And so one of this movement of looking at vedana and learning to just be very simple and relaxed around whether things are pleasant or unpleasant is one of the doorways to allow something deeper to well up. And so the last thing I wanted to say is that in looking at this very simple knowing that can happen in our experience, the Buddha also distinguishes between the knowing that happens when the sense world comes into us. So there's the five senses. We feel sensation, then we know what it is. But there's a whole other universe, a very simple knowing that happens when the inner world is activated. And the inner world is activated in ways that can be pleasant or unpleasant as well. And one of the interesting words that I like to use for this is this inner world that we have, the inner world of feelings, sensations, thoughts, reactions, and all that. It's also possible to evaluate or to feel, is it pleasant or unpleasant what's happening? The Buddha had a number of different ways of distinguishing between the outer vedana, the knowing of the outer world, the sense world, and the knowing of this inner world. And this is not what I'm going to offer you is not the category of the Buddha, but I find it helpful. So once we kind of tune into the inner world, you know, so for example, if you have a thought, that thought can be pleasant or unpleasant. You can feel content, and that contentment has a nice, pleasant feeling somehow within. You can feel at peace, and within it feels kind of peaceful. You can feel love or joy, and it has an inner kind of wellspring of energy that feels nice and pleasant. And you can feel all those things without necessarily your senses being stimulated, just kind of an inner world that arises. And so the category I like to use is the inner vedana, the inner felt sense, or the inner knowing. Is it nourishing or not? Is it nourishing or not? And one of the ways to be the caretaker of your heart, of your inner life, is to begin to become wise about what are the inner ways of being, what are the inner feelings that we can have that that nourish us, and what are the inner feelings we have that drain us. To look at that and see what goes on, nourishing and draining. So my hope is that your meditation practice, your mindfulness practice, your ability to be present for your life will offer you tremendous inner nourishment, and that nourishment feeds you in such a way that it becomes easier and easier to be relaxed about whether the external world is pleasant or unpleasant, because you're nourished from the inside. So, thank you. So we have the potluck now, and it's very nice, I think, for the